It's over. The junior and leaving certs are done. Our eldest finished his last exam last Wednesday, and I feel more wrecked now than I did after my own doctoral viva. State exams. I was clueless. For years, I was puzzled when neighbours or colleagues would ask each other, "Do you have anyone for exams this year?" I wondered, why all the fuss? After all, when I did the old inter back in Finglas in 1985, it seemed me ma and da took it all in their stride. I was one of 10 children, seventh in line, and more interested in wandering by the River Talca, listening to Joan Baez outsing Bob Dylan at Live Aid, or enjoying wild parties in the Ballymun Flats. And even though I was my parents' first child to do the Leaving Cert, they still took a laissez-faire attitude. I was their seventh kid, the youngest girl who read Wuthering Heights every winter and kept a copy of Songs of Innocence and Experience under the pillow of her bunk bed. I don't think my parents even knew what subjects I was doing, much less my exam timetable. But they were the ones who brought me up in a house full of songs written by W.B. Yeats, Brendan Behan, or Paddy Kavanagh. Also, my folks were the ones who gave me that novel by Emily Bronte and those poems by William Blake. They had the measure of me. Now, our firstborn has done the junior cert. This is the child who's so laid back he's nearly horizontal. A fella who'd rather puzzle out the chords for an Ed Sheeran song than memorise the biographical details of Johann Sebastian Bach. Or touch the textures of pebbles and shells rather than study the formation of igneous, sedimentary and metamorphic rocks. As for the abstract reasoning required for certain aspects of maths, my young fella likes to quote Einstein. "Do not worry too much about your difficulties in mathematics. I can assure you that mine are still greater." Jesus, where do I start with the likes of that? Our child is not a standard learner, and standard exams don't measure him. Nonetheless, since January, myself and the husband were banging on about study skills and exam techniques. I went out and bought all the past papers, index cards, and a bunch of books called Less Stress, More Success. Yes, I know now the irony lurking in those titles. And you think I'm bad? I have mates who banned all technology coming up to the exams. One mother left the house every morning with the internet router in her handbag. Another father changed the language settings of the PlayStation, hoping it might help his Leaving Cert son do better in his German exam. Whole families sat down to watch Romeo and Juliet or Macbeth with the intention of the examinee learning at least the plot line. One couple ditched the English language altogether around the time of the orals. The mother spoke French and the father Irish in hopes their daughter might improve her je m'appelle and couple focal. And don't get me started on parents or friends of parents roped in to help finish so-called classroom-based assessments, art portfolios, woodworking, technical graphic or domestic science projects. For all that, these last weeks of the actual exams, it's been head down, shoulder in and get on with the work. We parents have been relegated to the sidelines and had to let go and let our kids get on with the solo work of the exam hall. We did what our folks did with us. Fed them a good breakfast, made sure they got to the exam hall on time, wished them luck and afterwards minded them with as much care as needed. We've been there when our super chilled son nearly lost the plot because he couldn't find the calculator the night before his business exam. His little brother found it under the kitchen radiator. We've been there to pick up our junior certer, pale and tired after a long day of back-to-back science and maths exams. We've been there to watch himself and his mates run giddily out of the exam, the last exam, music, of course, and into a night of celebration. Nothing quite like the last day of a state exam to signal the first night of a long teenage summer. It is over. Say it. The junior and leaving certs have finished. Well, until next year, the next child, or the next time. But I understand it now, that question. Do you have anyone for exams this year? Has an answer. Yes. And the only thing worse than doing the junior or leaving cert is watching your child do it. And the only thing better than finishing the junior or leaving cert is seeing the relief on the face of your child when the exams are over.
John the Baptist and I had an odd relationship in primary school. Because of my failure to grasp the purpose of the father, the little sign that tells you to lengthen a vowel in Irish, I found it hard to distinguish between words such as boshtuch, rain, and bashtia, baptism. Most 10-year-olds growing up in Dublin would take this phonological confusion in their stride, but my circumstances were different. My old primary school, Belgrove National School, was known in Irish as Scoil Ón Baistea, the school of John the Baptist, for the very good reason that it's located in the parish of St. John the Baptist. For me, the closeness of the two words boshtuch and baistea meant my child's imagination conjured up a version of John, who, despite spending much of his time in the desert, was somehow a permanently rain-sodden, bedraggled figure. I imagined him alone, crying in the wilderness, glumly preparing a meal of locusts and honey, while his own personal rain-laden cloud hovered close overhead in an otherwise blue sky. Other details of his story also caught my imagination. I felt for his aging parents, who'd given up hope of ever having a child. I was intrigued by how the babe leapt in Elizabeth's womb when Mary came to visit. I was puzzled by his relationship with his distant cousin Jesus and his self-effacing announcement that he wasn't worthy to untie Jesus' sandals. I certainly didn't feel like that about any of my cousins. My heart went out to him. There, I felt, was a man who hadn't had a fair crack of the whip. There was a man who, if he were alive now, would benefit from an assertiveness course. Years ago, when I started spending time in the west of Ireland, I realised that perhaps I wasn't alone in feeling he had been undervalued. I discovered that St. John's Eve, the 23rd of June, was a special date in the Connemara calendar. It was the custom, I was told, in parts of Connemara and elsewhere, to light bonfires on hilltops and headlands. While I suspected that this practice was more likely to be related to pagan celebrations of the summer solstice, I had enough affection for the old faith to want to persuade myself that these bonfires were part of a nationwide program to grant a saintly man a little bit of the recognition he had shunned during his life. One summer, more than 30 years ago, my neighbour near Ranstone told me that he'd been assembling materials for a bonfire at Crucón an Túirin. It was years since he had lit a bonfire. It was going to be a big Bonefire, he said with pride, and I should come along. Even though I knew well that Sean's first language was Irish, I did the unforgivable and took the opportunity to correct his pronunciation. Do you mean bonfire, Sean? He didn't bat an eyelid. Well, it's Tina Crov in Irish, so there must be a bone in there somewhere. Unlike my manners, his etymology was beyond reproach. I learned later that bones were indeed frequently placed in bonfires, St. John's Eve bonfires and others, hence the term. When I joined him at his bonfire on Crochán an Túri, he was alone, drinking from a can of beer. He reminisced about how in the old days people would say prayers around the fire. There would be music and singing. The young men would vie with one another to jump back and forth through the flames. Cattle would be driven through the dying embers to ward off disease, and the embers would then be placed in a corner of a field to help the crops. He wasn't sure if he believed in any of that now. He was just doing it for old time's sake. Nobody else was bothered. Sure, this might be my last. It was his last. He died a few years later without ever setting another bonfire. St. John's Eve belonged to the old times, like so much else in his life. His strength as a curragh rower counted for nothing now that everyone had an outboard motor. His skill as a set dancer, of no value now that everyone preferred television. This day last year, St. John's Eve, around 7 in the evening, I stood near the southern tip of Inishni and checked the coastline from Glinsk to Letterard with binoculars for signs of a bonfire. I could see nothing. I walked up the hill at Kinraver to get a better look. I thought I could see a plume of smoke a few miles to the south near Half Mace, but that was all. A poor showing. Sean was right. Nobody was bothered. A few hours later, I decided to head out again and climbed another hill that affords an almost uninterrupted view of Roundstone, Errisbeg and Bertraboy Bay. Although it was nearly 11 o'clock at night, it was still essentially daylight, bright enough for me to make out the colours of the fields in Letterard across the bay. As I reached the crest of the hill, I felt my heart lift as I counted 4 bonfires on Errisbeg, a gentle north wind blowing smoke out towards the sea. There was one over at Cashel, and a further 5 along the stretch from Glinsk to Carna. A particularly bright fire was burning furiously down near the shore, more than 2 miles away at Collamore. If Sean had been alive, he would have been able to see it easily from his favourite vantage point, just leaning in the doorway of his house in Kinraver. It was a beautiful sight, and it would have lifted his heart too. I thought to myself, fair play to John the Baptist.
Although half English born, I had very little contact with England until I was dispatched, in my early teens, to a school near Runnymede on the River Thames, where, on a warm summer afternoon in 1965, I encountered Grimsby Man. Admittedly, there had been journeys by boat and an eye-watering, grit-spitting steam train to London, where Bill and Ben, the flowerpot men, entertained me in an aunt's house, on television, a novelty to me. I fell asleep to the honking of the river police launches patrolling the Thames at Barnes Bridge. Another train journey took us to Worthing on the south coast and grandparents. My grandfather, Sidney, tall and bespectacled, had survived the trenches in the First War. He drove a Woolsey, which carried a whiff of the walnut in the dashboard. Although I never heard him sing, he had apparently a fine tenor voice and claimed, without any hard evidence to back it up, descent from our very own bard, Tom Moore. As a widower with a 2-year-old daughter, my mother, Sidney had remarried before the war broke out. My mother and his second wife had an edgy relationship. From Worthing, we went inland to deepest Sussex to stay with a bluff uncle, a countryman to his fingertips, who grew carnations under glass. His two sons, my cousins, older than I, collected butterflies, played rugby, and were flummoxed by having to entertain a younger Irish relative. It was only when I arrived from abroad at an eccentric school at Seaford on the south coast, not far from Worthing, that I was introduced to the mindset and values from which Middle England is crafted. Presided over by a rotund headmaster known as Piggy and his wife, they had discovered a lucrative niche in patching up children, mostly of expatriate parents, whose education had somehow fallen between the cracks. Our days began with an early morning run, led by an Anglo-Irish teacher with a Norman-sounding surname, along the South Downs and up to Beachy Head, already claimed in verse for England in Chesterton's The Rolling English Road. This was followed by a cold shower and a daily dose of malt extract to make up for our nutrient-free meals, all the goodness having been boiled out of them. At weekends, I was more or less free to roam, unsupervised, by bicycle over the downs, to villages with unfamiliar names, Alfriston, Litlington, Lunnington, and Pidding Ho. As the only Catholic and Irish to boot, I became used to making a solitary trek to Saturday evening mass. Thus, the following year found me at a secondary boarding school manned by Jesuits, which was sandwiched between Windsor Great Park and the Thames at Runnymede. The 750th anniversary of the signing at Runnymede of the Great Charter of Magna Carta on the 15th of June 1215 was celebrated that summer. At the insistence of his barons, many of them from the north, King John had been forced to trammel his absolute powers as monarch. Over 1,000 people, bishops, barons, knights, squires and their attendants, had milled around the plain to witness the event. In a final twist, Archbishop Stephen Langton, smarting at John's refusal to appoint him to the See of Canterbury, added two late clauses which have survived to this day. The first was that no free man could be arrested without trial, now known as habeas corpus. The second was that access to justice should be neither delayed nor denied. As I joined the crush of celebrants walking along the towpath, passing the Bells of Ouseley, a riverside pub, towards the plain at Runnymede, a man in walking gear and boots struck up a conversation. He had made the 5-hour journey that morning from Grimsby, the fishing port in Lincolnshire, on the south bank of the Humber estuary, which is fed by the rivers Ouse and Trent on their way to the sea in the coastal heartland of the north. The Queen had travelled from Windsor Castle, 3 miles away, and Jackie Kennedy from America, to unveil a memorial overlooking the site to the late President, slain a bare 18 months previously. For Grimsby man, this was no mere day trip. This was a pilgrimage. He had high hopes of an imminent people's revolt. "Us in the north have had enough of being ruled by those southerners in London. Aye, lad, we want our freedom. Mark my words, we'll march south soon enough. Just you wait and see." I wonder now, what had really inspired Grimsby man to make his pilgrimage? Was it the symbol of power exercised by those northern barons from the Wash and the Humber on their wayward king? No doubt it was also the prospect of Englishmen and women, good and true, assembling together on the very ground where the king had been forced to give way over 3/4 of a millennium ago. The presence of Queen Elizabeth as successor in a long, uninterrupted line of kings and queens since the time of King John served as a reminder, perhaps, of the power of the people over despots. And to top it all, the elegant modernism of Jackie Kennedy, widow of a Democratic president who hailed from Irish roots, must have played its part.
"Our ma couldn't kick snow off a rope," my father said one Sunday when our ma was to play an Ulster senior football semi-final in Clonus. We watched to see how my mother would respond, but she said nothing, just went on twisting her long, frizzy hair into a soft bun at the back of her head, with a look on her face that said, "Fermanagh can talk." He would have enjoyed a football match, my father. You can tell that from a photograph taken in the 1960s at the Newcastle Fish. He and some other man are watching a game. My father's arms are folded against his chest. His face is thrust forward and his whole body is taut with concentration on the play. One of the parts of him that faded into the past as the years of his adulthood passed by in northeast County Down, along with the accordion he had played in a band. Sometimes late at night, when everyone else had gone to bed and he was alone and the fire was out, you would hear him pick out a tune he'd played long ago when he was young and among his own kind, in a pub or a dance hall, in Clonus or Ballybay or Emmaville. Because in that pub, in that seaside town, where he and my mother spent their uprooted lives, my father was not among his own kind. He said he hated the sea, but I don't think he hated the sea. I think he hated what accrued in that place by the sea. The Union Jacks, the band practices leading up to the 12th of July every year, and Black Saturday. He would have felt alienated by the Protestant churches and people's names like Moore and Reed, Boyd and Bunting and Bowl. And yet he had no friends among the other Catholics who lived in our town, though these were few in number and mostly from the south and west of Ireland. Did his encounters with them remind him that he too was a stranger and that he would never recover what he had left behind? Because on those occasions when he visited his home place, wearing a suit and a white shirt and tie, he was a stranger in the small kitchen with the range and linoleum-covered floor, and Uncle Henry sitting on a straight chair he'd pulled out from the kitchen table. On those visiting Sundays, he would drive first to my mother's home in Dougherty, near Middletown, then cross the border into Monaghan, from Monaghan town to Rosslea, and then to a small farmhouse just off the road at the foot of a hill in the townland of Fife, where he was born. Between the dark green hills and fields and trees of his home and the congealed air of the seaside town where he and my mother raised their family, my father found one supreme pleasure: golf. It seems strange that he should have been drawn to the game of golf, when the golf club in our town in those days was largely made up of wealthy Protestants with the accents that were more English than Irish, men who wore cravats and soft woollen pullovers and drove Jaguar cars. But he was good at it. He practiced his swing in the garden, and you would come across him from time to time absorbed in the study of the exact distance to draw back an imaginary putter to hit the ball with just enough weight to send it into the hole. In the months before his death, he would walk up the back lane to the golf course with a 4 or 5 iron in his hand to swing in the rough grass at the back of what used to be the 7th green. I think he found in the game an escape from those dead hours in the afternoon in the bar, and a sense of freedom in the open space of the links, the satisfaction of a straight and soaring drive down a fairway recently mown and smelling of cut grass. He played at least 9 holes every day. At weekends, he sometimes joined others to play at Shandon or Clandeboy or Mahee. Mostly, though, he played alone, a solitary figure ranging over the sandy links of our town. In winter, making his way home in the cold and the fading light, the sky rose-coloured or gold-coloured or mint-coloured in the west.
Postcard from Santorini. Red beach, white beach, black beach, the boatmen cry. Brides with urban faces pose in the sea. And there's a woman with the ancient Greek alphabet tattooed along the vertebrae of her spine. Rich tourists in helicopters fly into the famous sunset. Asians take photographs high, low, cameras they can't be separated from. Mules and donkeys climb the walls of the caldera. A man hangs from a parachute, a speedboat dragging him through the sky. In Fira, people sit on long benches, their feet in aquariums as tiny fish nibble hard skin from their souls. Lillian shows me how to tie a silk dress, Grecian style, below my breasts. The pomegranates have not ripened. There are cigarette butts strewn around my sunbed. Houses cling to the top of the cliff like snow. Indigo waves sluice over the backs of two children, diving under and over their mother. A man unloads ice from the back of a truck. Buried by a volcano, the island has risen again, and in the museum, Kore is almost perfect, the champagne stone of her face just missing a nose. In my cave house, there are no windows. The sheets are red and the fan is not working. I wish you were here.
Although I have searched many times in various locations down through the years, I have never come across or even seen a four-leaf clover. A universal symbol of good luck, it is also the logo of the Alfa Romeo racing car team. Considered a rarity, the four-leaf clover has an occurrence in nature of about one in every 10,000 plants. Although in areas where genetic mutations of the plant are cultivated for commercial purposes, the figure can drop to one in 5,000. These four-leaf clovers are picked, preserved in clear plastic, and sold as lucky charms. My father once found a four-leaf clover whilst looking for shamrock and promptly gave it to his companion with a wish that it would bring him luck. "Thanks, but I think it's too late for that," the man replied, with despair in his voice. The incident happened in the early 1950s. My father was a prison officer in Mountjoy Jail, and the man in his company was a prisoner who had been condemned to death and was due to be executed the day after St. Patrick's Day. He had been found guilty of committing a murder, and the mandatory penalty on the statute books was death by hanging. As the day of his execution drew nearer, the prisoner could request an officer to be with him up until his final moment, when the noose went around his neck and the trapdoor was sprung. This concession was not just to provide the prisoner with some comfort in his final hours, but also to make sure that he did not commit suicide. The prisoner, a young man in his 20s, had asked for my father to be with him for the last days of his life. I vaguely remember the tension in our home as my parents spoke quietly and at length about the terrible imposition placed on my father's shoulders and how we should respond. My father had served in the army during the Second World War and had seen enough of man's inhumanity to man for him to hold the belief that no matter how righteous the cause, nothing could justify inflicting pain and suffering on another human being. My father was totally opposed to capital punishment. A phrase he used repeatedly was, "The further the mob is from the prison walls, the louder they shout for hanging." With support and encouragement from my mother, my father did all he could to take the prisoner's mind off his imminent demise. They played chess, talked of trivial things, and walked in the grounds of Mountjoy Jail when all of the other inmates had been locked up. It was during one of these final walks on St. Patrick's Day that my father found the four-leaf clover. Albert Pierpoint, the hangman, had already weighed and measured the prisoner. Pierpoint prided himself on his reputation for walking a condemned man from cell to gallows and completing his terrible business in less than 1 minute. The hangman was also the landlord of a pub in Oldham near Manchester, and apparently saw no irony in the fact that it was called Help the Poor Struggler. This would be Pierpoint's 12th execution in Mountjoy, adding to his tally of over 500 in his 30-year career. His fee per assignment had increased from 3 guineas in the 1930s to £10. The hanging would take place at 8 a.m. the following morning. The family of the murder victim in this particular case, true to their deeply held Christian beliefs, petitioned the Minister for Justice to show clemency and asked for the death sentence to be commuted. However, the prisoner's own legal team had not lodged an appeal, and so the execution order was still in place. The long night dragged on. The conversation in the death cell ceased. The two men, my father and the prisoner, waited for the dawn. Sometime in the early hours of March the 18th, the Governor of Mountjoy received a phone call from the Minister for Justice, who ordered a stay of execution pending an appeal. My father and the condemned man were so overcome that they said nothing for some time. Then, as relief swept over them, they shook hands and made some light-hearted comment about the four-leaf clover found among the shamrock.
On this morning's programme, the written pieces we heard were The Junior and Leaving Cert Are Over, which was by Rachel Hegarty, Fair Play to John the Baptist by Conal Hamill, The Reeds at Runnymede was by Justin McCarthy, Carol Nicholas brought us Exile, and then we heard Postcard from Santorini, a poem by Lanny O'Hanlon, and finally Clover, which was by Joe Taylor. The music this morning was Forever Young by Joan Baez, Mountain Tay, Hills of Connemara, played by the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. Summer Is A-Comin' In, played on trumpets and organ by Mark David, Andrew Millington and Alistair Mackey. Then O Store of My Heart, on accordion, played by Tony McMahon. And to end, the theme from Zorba the Greek by Mikis Theodorakis.